From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea, and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
If you haven't seen the commissioning ceremony for the HMAS supply, it's worth a Google. For reasons that are yet to be fully explained, someone thought it was appropriate to have a scantily clad dance troupe twerk and gyrate in front of this brand new Royal Australian Navy warship, all while a collection of dignitaries looked on. It's the most cringeworthy thing to happen to a Navy, well, since this.
If I could turn back time, if I could find a way, I'd take back those words that hurt you, and you'd stay.
But even Cher riding the cannon of the USS Missouri in her undies was less embarrassing than what happened to the HMAS supply. I've got to be honest, when I first saw the footage, I thought the whole thing was a prank played on the Navy, the kind of publicity stunt Amazon might pull to promote a new Borat movie. But as far as I can tell, the dance routine was legit. Now, I don't want to shame the dancers. They're the hapless victims in all of this, hired to do a job, and they did it to the best of their abilities. What we really need to focus on here is why they were hide in the first place, because I'm struggling to understand how anyone thought it was acceptable. The best bit about it was this dance troupe had a vaguely military uniform and is called the 101 Doll Squadron. Is it possible the person who booked them thought they were getting a marching band? Was the person who booked the troupe related to one of the dancers and thought they were doing them a favour? That's about the only way you could justify it, but that of course doesn't take into account just how inappropriate the whole thing was. But you know what? I'm grateful that someone made this absolute clanger of a mistake, because lately the lapses in judgment we've seen from those in power have been far from laughing matters. They've been horrible. They've been disgusting. They've been reprehensible. This one is just mind-numbingly silly, and it gave us all something to joke about. Coming up on the show, the Eagles game against Collingwood at Optus Stadium could have the biggest crowd the Southern Hemisphere has seen since COVID hit. We'll talk to the stadium CEO. Plus, the issue of black deaths in custody is a stain on this nation. We'll shine a spotlight on it. But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live. Making news.
Joining me now in the studio, Sunrise correspondent Matt Tinney. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Ben. Thank you very much for having me back. I'm still gobsmacked about those dancers, hey?
That's one of my favourite stories of the week. I can't wait to find out more about how it happened because I'm at a loss to explain it.
Can you imagine the utopia-style meeting that led to that happening? You know, there would have definitely been a few people, I reckon, in the meeting that saying, I don't think this is a good idea. You know, the treatment of women's under the spotlight now, the optics aren't good on this. And next minute they've got the, you know, the military version of the Pussycat Dolls.
At this stage, I'm willing to believe anything. Like maybe it was a plot by the Chinese government to embarrass our armed forces. Like anything is more likely than people in the Navy thinking it was a good idea.
I'm with you. I thought it was a Borat prank. I thought, how can this be real?
It can't.
And you know what was so jarring was in the vision, you see the performance, and then all these military head honchos.
Oh, the
in
looks
full
on their
regalia
faces.
And just not knowing what to do or how to react. Like, you know, if you need to find out the definition of juxtaposition, that's right.
It was, as you say, exactly like something you'd expect to see in Utopia, a spoof.
Yeah. How is it real? I still can't believe that it's real.
Yeah, I know.
And can we please get to the bottom of who approved it?
Yeah.
Who was the person who sourced it? Clearly, they would have had to watch a performance. Like, they would have had to go to rehearsals.
Well, you
would have thought.
The city of Perth even vets buskers before they busk in the mall.
Look, they could do a little more vetting, I think.
Yeah, I think there's some serious problems
when you
there.
Say vet, I'd love to know who's actually
and what
doing
what happened
the
to
vetting.
The old champagne bottle across the prow of the ship?
Yeah, well, that's
gone
now.
That's a classic.
Now. That's gone now. Did they do that with the military ships, though?
I
or is that
know.
Just your kind of P&O fair star?
Your pleasure craft. Now, this is another story that's shocking for very different reasons. We woke up this morning to to really hear this tragic story from a Christian college in Perth's north.
Yeah, awful story. An 11-month-old baby has been found dead at a school in Perth's northern suburbs. That school is Kingsway Christian College, which is in Dart. Forensic police have been there overnight scouring this college. They've also been having a close look at a Toyota Tarago. We understand there is a daycare centre that's situated at the college, but this is all unfolding, how this came about, whether there are suspicious circumstances or not. We do know that police have taken somebody into custody who's assisting them with their inquiries at the moment, but it's very early days. Information's just filtering through. St John Ambulance have told us that they sent three ambulances to this incident. We know that when they do that sort of thing, it's when there's an issue with somebody not breathing or something like that. So this will unfold throughout the day. Obviously, keep on thewest.com.au and on Channel 7 today, and we're expecting more details to unfold, but just absolute tragedy.
And watching on Sunrise this morning, you know, the neighbours reporting that this army of police and ambulances descended on this college yesterday evening. It's hard to fathom how this end result could have happened.
Yes.
Obviously, much still to be found out about this story. No charges have been laid yet, but I guess we'll wait and see where the police go from here.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, you know, with the fact the daycare centre's there, that could be a link to how this has all happened, but, you know, it could be something completely different. So we're waiting for all that information to come through. And because it's an ongoing investigation that's quite high level, the Major Crime Squad's looking into this, that's why there hasn't been a lot of information that's come out as yet.
And then let's cross to Kalbarri. The ongoing devastation, the cleanup is underway after Cyclone Seroja, but there's a new health risk for the locals up there.
Yeah, the big issue is asbestos. They've gone through the properties, and something like 35% of the properties assessed so far have an asbestos issue. And what's happened is this cyclone has come through, the asbestos has just broken up all over town from, you know, roofs, from fences, from walls. And so there are fibres everywhere. The wind's up a bit there today. So it's a big issue, of course, with diseases caused by exposure to asbestos. And we've seen firefighters up there scraping the asbestos off the road, because what's happening is these broken panels are all over the road. The cars go and drive over them and create the dust, and the fibres become airborne. So firefighters are up there scraping the road. They're hosing down the roads as well. But it's going to take a long time to get the experts from Perth who deal with this
thing. They're licensed.
They have to get up there. It's going to be a painstaking task. It's not like, you know, a demolition here in Perth where it's a self-contained house and they remove the asbestos. This is asbestos strewn everywhere. We saw this morning on Sunrise, Jeff Parry just out there, and there's fibres galore just all over the road from cars that have driven over these broken panels.
Just another challenge for the people up there who've already endured so much. Well, thanks, Maddie, for keeping us updated. We'll talk to you tomorrow on The West Live.
We'll do. Have a great day, Ben.
Now, 30 years ago today, a landmark report was handed down into a Royal Commission into black deaths in custody. Today, there will be protesters calling for action from all levels of government to address what some are calling a national crisis. The West Australian has today released a special 5-part video series investigation into the issue. And joining me now is Indigenous Affairs reporter Rangi Harini. Rangi, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
And now, this is a major anniversary, but it's nothing that we should be celebrating.
No, the issue of Black Lives Matter or deaths in custody, it came to the forefront for mainstream media or people outside the Aboriginal community and their supporters last June when we had our BLM movement here in Australia. But the issue of stopping black deaths in custody and the concern around Indigenous incarceration has been around for years and decades. One of the big numbers that are coming out over the past week is that since this Royal Commission was handed down 30 years ago, there have been 474 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have died in custody. And there were 339 recommendations made to stop them. And it's been 36 months. So there's a lot of numbers, but the main number people should be focusing on is that at least one person every month of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander descent is dying in custody. And that's an Australian citizen. That's an Australian. We should be caring. And it's a human being. This is fathers, mothers, sisters. These are people that, in some cases, they were preventable. And if recommendations that were made from this Royal Commission were implemented, these people could be alive. There could be many people still alive.
Mm. And you think about the cost on the communities that where these people come from. It reaches far beyond individual cases. And now, what was the incident or series of incidents that launched the Royal Commission in the first place?
Yeah, so what we will look into in the first part is what started the Royal Commission and what had happened. And what it was the death of a teenager, a 16-year-old who a community said was going to be the leader, and his name was John Pat. It's a story many people know, but that's a story that people in the Aboriginal community may know. And it's an incident that happened in Roebourne, which it's a small little town up in the state's northwest. And no one was ever committed. No one was ever convicted over that crime. And people were outraged. This is a teenager who got into a physical altercation with police officers, people who were meant to serve and protect. And he was found dead in their cells. No one was ever held accountable. The community went through so much trauma. They had to really dig themselves out of where they were to change the narrative of what was being written about them in order to have a better future for their younger generation. And that's what happens in a lot of small towns, in a lot of these small communities where a black death happens, is you have this, what someone, one of the nieces said, is this fog around you where you can't get rid of that. And it really comes down to the individuals and community leaders and elders to say, we are not going to let this determine our future and we are going to turn it around. But there should also be government support in that as well.
Now, this is an incredible series that you've produced. It's heart-wrenching to watch for anybody. You've been investigating it for several months, spoken to families that have been involved, that have lost loved ones. How has it been for you personally as an Indigenous woman and as a journalist?
Well, I'm actually Indjibarndi, which is the group that John Pat is a part of. I also grew up in Port Hedland, which is where Miss Jew died. Miss Jew is a distant family member of mine. Her auntie, which is her nana's sister, helped raise me and was working at the daycare that my mum used to own in Port Hedland. So I feel very connected just off those elements. But I also know in any of these cases, whether it was Miss Drew, whether it was John Pat, whether it was Mr. Ward, this could have easily been a family member. So knowing that there were cases where race, my race, being Aboriginal, played a factor in the life or death of these people, especially in situations where their skin colour was only looked at and not medical conditions were looked at, that plays a big element of wanting to get justice, but also wanting the community to know that as much as it's hard to face, racism has played factors and is a factor in Australia when it comes to the treatment of minority groups such as Aboriginal people.
And we know that's the case with the justice system. We know it's the case with the health system where there are poor outcomes and the determining factor is purely the colour of a person's skin. It beggars belief when it comes to the justice system, that you could have a Royal Commission, cost millions of dollars, and come up with these recommendations, yet so little has changed. What are some of the recommendations that have been adopted, the some that haven't been adopted, and what do you think the key is moving forward?
I think the key moving forward is we need to get recommendations and policy changes before people die. What we have seen in some of the most significant cases where an offence was an offence that a white person would have committed and changes were only made after an Aboriginal woman has died is deaths like that of Auntie Tanya Day over in Victoria. She was arrested for being drunk in public. Now you think of the Melbourne Cup and how many people are drunk in public after the Melbourne Cup and catch a train. How many of those people end up dead in a prison cell or in a police lockup? Not many, but it took the death of a 55-year-old mother and grandmother in order for Victoria to make those changes of being drunk in public, that how many of us have committed that crime. Miss Jew here in Western Australia, they only changed the fine default laws after she died. This was something that covered two recommendations and they waited until she died, and she was born the same year these recommendations were handed down. It shouldn't be taking lives to save lives. It should just be a matter of we have the blueprint. the Royal Commission recommendations. We've got the determination. We've had 447 black deaths. We need to stop that. Let's just get on with the job. It should be simple, but it just seems like it's being complicated at the top level.
Well, and you make a very good point here that so much of this is simple. This is not based on things that we don't know. This is based on evidence that has been gathered over decades, not just from the Royal Commission, but in the years that have followed. There are so many things that are difficult to fix, but stopping Indigenous people from dying in custody, there are some simple things that we can do today. So this protest that will happen, what do you expect to see from that protest, and how would you describe the mood of the protesters?
I will say, I would say people are probably angry. It's the 30 years is today. So emotions are high. I've heard there may be family members of those who are part of this 474 number. So you can expect frustration and anger. But I think there is also going to be a sense of hope that we are at the boiling point. Enough is enough. We've had the huge momentum and move last year, that we've seen that with Australia Day, the Invasion Day protest this year, the biggest turnout in Perth history so far. I would say there's frustration, but there's also hope in moving forward. And at this point, are we going to have to get to 500? Like, I hope that's not the case. But we're almost there, and that's not good enough.
Do you think Indigenous West Australians see Premier Mark McGowan as an ally or a roadblock?
I think they've seen him as both of them. I think no tea, no shade, so no offence to Colin Barnett, but it was very easy to come across as the hero in that case because of some of the things that he had done during his time in office, like the threat to close remote communities, like the things that he had done with the James Price Point. There was a lot that he had done that it was very easy to come in and look good. And his government
is... Dare I say, look like a white saviour.
Yeah, and his government is trying. You've got John Quigley, who was the police union lawyer in the John Pat case. He was on, quote-unquote, the bad side, and now he's the person who's making these changes and even said that Ms. Drew was the catalyst for change for the fine default laws. But I think it's just a matter of, okay, you've had these 4 years, you've done some changes, but now you've got all this power in Parliament. It should be the time where they can be making these changes without having that buck from the other side. It should be easy now than ever.
Mm. Well, people can read your special series at thewest.com.au, and there is also an incredibly powerful 5-part video series which listeners can watch at thewest.com.au. Indigenous Affairs reporter Rangi Hirini, thanks for being on The West Live today.
Thanks for having me.
Now that Premier Mark McGowan has scrapped COVID restrictions at Perth's major venues, tomorrow night's footy game between the Eagles and Collingwood could have the biggest crowd the Southern Hemisphere has seen since COVID-19 hit. Joining me now is Optus Stadium CEO Mike McKenna. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Ben.
Now, how many footy fans are you expecting through the gates tomorrow night?
Well, we're expecting upwards of 50,000. I'd say somewhere between 50 and 55 would be expected tomorrow evening.
Wow, I was talking to Prime Minister Scott Morrison yesterday. He'll be one of your guests tomorrow night. And he said just how incredible it is, looking at what is happening around the world, that we can have a footy stadium with upwards of 50,000 people in it. Is that how you're feeling?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're extremely lucky here in WA, particularly the run we've had and the fact that we can come back so hard at the stadium like we've got. To enjoy football, and so many other places around the world are struggling to even stage events behind closed doors.
Mm. And can you take us through what sort of preparations you've been making this week to get ready for that return to close to full capacity?
Yeah, look, I think it's pretty much the same as we've seen for every other sort of start of a season, both football and cricket, that we've had a lot of work going into cleaning the venue, making sure it's ready for people to come and arrive. We've been buying the produce we need to have to serve to people, both in the public and corporate areas. And making sure that the surface is going to be a great one to play on. I think the biggest challenge we've had really is recruiting, and I think that everyone in the hospitality industry here in Perth and WA and around the country is struggling in that area just to get the numbers of people in the absence of the overseas students and the overseas backpackers who actually form such a big part of the workforce in hospitality.
Yeah, we talk about some vacancies. The average pub or cafe in the hospitality industry might need to hire a couple of baristas, maybe a waiter or two. Can you give us an idea of how many staff you desperately need at the stadium?
Yeah, look, we're going to roster about 1,500 shifts. So that's 1,500 people working a shift for this game. Probably next week will be another about 1,350, and then back for the Derby, another 1,500 staff are required. So it's a large amount. And
you know, it's right a huge amount.
It is. It is. It's a great source of employment. Events at Optus Stadium. We do employ a lot of people, and the people who are either students or they're retired workers or people just looking for a few extra dollars to put on the table at the end of the week. And we have a game most weeks, but we also have a lot of other business and other social events that we put on at the stadium. It's a great source of employment. Right at the moment, it's a challenge, and I think it's not a challenge we face on our own, but we're certainly looking forward to the day when those people who do work in hospitality and support us and others are able to come back to Australia.
Mm. And you think now that the JobKeeper payments have ended, that some of the younger people who are getting those prop-ups from the government might be more eager to find paid employment?
Well, we're certainly hoping there is some of that around, although at this stage we haven't seen that dramatic a change. Now, we had a lot of people on JobKeeper in our casual workforce, and they've been working on and off throughout the period, whether it be for the football hub last year, cricket, or in our major events that we put on for the business community. So we've had people working the whole time. We're not sure that there's very many who are sitting there spending their JobKeeper money, but we're certainly hoping there are a few.
Mm. And so how many people do you need to employ as of today?
Oh, we're probably a couple of hundred short at the moment.
A couple of hundred.
And we're making phone calls all the time to people who have worked for us before. We're recruiting flat out. So anybody who would like to work at the stadium, and it could be in customer service, greeting people at the gates or at the top of aisles, making sure that they can move around the stadium, working in any of our food and beverage outlets or in our premium hospitality spaces, if they're a chef or a cook, or even the logistics, moving beer kegs around the venue. You can go to optusstadium.com.au and click on the link. That'll take you through the job section. Anybody who wants to work, we're looking to recruit.
Fantastic. Looks like a great way to earn a bit of pocket money. And now you talk about the premium hospitality. You've got the VIP of all VIPs in the venue on Friday night, the Prime Minister of Australia. Are there things you need to do to prepare for such a VIP?
Probably the best way to answer that is to say that all of the people who come to the stadium are VIPs, and there are VIPs in both the public areas and the premium areas. And I'm sure that the Prime Minister will be treated like all the other guests in premium hospitality spaces. He's a guest of the West Coast Eagles, and I'm sure they'll look after him very well. There are a few things we have to do around security, make sure he gets in and out with his people, but that really is just making it a smooth entry and exit. So it's something we do quite often, whether it be for the Premier, for the Governor or others who just have a little bit of extra security around them.
Oh, yeah, you've got protocols in place for all that, as I'm sure you do. And I mentioned to the Prime Minister yesterday that he has to make sure he has a few Gage Rhodes beers while he's at the stadium. Can you give us an idea of how much beer the stadium might go through tomorrow night?
Yeah, look, if we get around that sort of 55,000, we'll probably pour about 70,000 beers on the night. And that'll be obviously accompanied by a responsible service of food as well. So probably 7,500 Mrs. Max pies and 14,500 cups of chips, and even probably about 6,000 hamburgers. So there's lots of food and beverage available, and there's a lot of work going in by our staff to prepare that in the days ahead. We've probably got about 4,000 meals we'll serve in the corporate areas as well. So lots of preparation, and our chefs are fantastic and doing a terrific job getting ready for the game.
Well, it's going to be a massive night at Optus, and we can't wait to see. Hopefully the West Coast gets a win. Optus Stadium CEO Mike McKenna, thanks for being on the West Live.
It's a pleasure.
You're listening to the West Live.
The Prime Minister is in WA, and he was treated to lunch in Kings Park yesterday, but he was met by a sea of protesters, including a young boy who flipped him the bird, a child flipping off the Prime Minister of Australia. Joining me now is parenting expert Claire Orange. Now, Claire, many adults will be looking at this photo in the newspaper today of this boy doing both hands are doing the one finger salute, and they're feeling slightly horrified. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, I think there should be some a righteous feeling horrified at a very young child showing that level of disrespect to the Prime Minister of Australia. And I do think that it's probably quite reflective of where many young Australians are at. Having been raised in a digital age where accountability with things like Facebook, you know, you can do and say what you like with a low level of accountability, and, you know, real life and digital life lines are blurred. And I think we're seeing that in our young people.
And so you think that people see this sort of behaviour on social media. We see it for everybody from celebrities down to people here in Perth doing this gesture in their selfies on social media, and they're perhaps not realising the real-life connotations of this gesture that is historically quite a rude gesture.
Absolutely, and I think there's also that low conceptualisation that what goes out on social media today and hits the media like it is now is also forming this permanent record into this child's future. So one day when he's 25 and applying for his first serious job, you know, this is still part of his resume. And these are the things that, you know, we as Australians need to be thinking about. And the stuff that goes on social media is usually low thought, low empathy, low connection, and we don't really think down the line what it's going to mean. And you're right, it's prolific.
And ScoMo obviously has his detractors, especially in the past couple of months, and some people will look at this kid like a hero. How much more difficult does that make, I guess, to parent?
Oh, exceptionally difficult. You know, when you have people rationalising disrespect. So we just have societal and cultural norms. And, you know, I guess it's even down to that real Australian vernacular that we use in referring to our Prime Minister as ScoMo. You know, even that starts to change the respect pathways that would have been in place. And we're seeing more and more of this. This child isn't a hero. In fact, this is really sad for Australians witnessing this and seeing that this is now an acceptable form of communication where we're not really looking at any levels of respect for you know, people in governance or people in positions of power that, you know, we shouldn't be allowing children to behave in this way.
And so what should we be doing here? Is this something parents need to be mindful of? Should we be watching what kids are doing on social media? Is there any way, I guess, to wind back the clock, or is it just the way society is now and we all just have to live with it?
No, I don't think we have to live with this. I don't think we have to perpetually downgrade our standards and dumb things down. I think that we can hold our children to higher account. And I would hope that today families are cutting out that picture from the West and showing their children and having discussions around the family table about what that means and what it means into their future and what their accountability is. And I hope families are watching their children on social media, and I hope schools are taking it seriously and using this as an education point, because if this is happening where a child is able to flip the bird at the Prime Minister, levels of respect go down in classrooms, it becomes a whole societal problem. So we can't let it slide. We can't just say it's a thing of today. We actually now have to start taking some strong measures to change this and to make sure it's part of our family narrative and dialogue.
It sounds like you're saying we shouldn't just laugh it off.
No, absolutely not. This, I know people will kind of think this is funny, and there will be an element of people that think this is hilarious and making a real statement, but it's not. In fact, it's a really sad indictment on where we are as a society. And as parents, we all need to lift our game. We need to hold our kids to higher account, because as I said at the beginning, we have to remember that what goes online about our children now, what they're posting and what we're posting about them, forms their digital resume when they're looking for a job one day. It has really big ramifications down the line.
Parenting expert Claire Orange, thanks for joining me on The West Live today.
My pleasure.
Mark Duffy.
By golly gosh.
And Glenn Quarterman.
Wow-wee.
Together, they are Duff and Quarters.
You know who.
Well, we're joined now by the Duff part of that equation, the West Australian's chief sports writer, Mark Duffield. G'day, Duff.
G'day, Benno. How are you going?
Good, mate. Now, how are the Eagles going to go tomorrow night at Optus?
I'm going to tip them to win. The interesting thing is, this time of year, every week there's a different team in the gun. And so in round three, when Fremantle went over to play Carlton, it was Carlton. And in round four, when Collingwood played GWS, it was GWS. And now Collingwood comes here and it's Collingwood. So you've got to be careful when you're playing a team that is in the gun, because it tends to light a fire under them. Obviously, we saw what Carlton did to Fremantle and we saw what GWS did to Collingwood. So West Coast will need to be careful, and they're still without Elliot Yeo and Luke Shuey, and will be for some time, and now Shannon Hearn as well. But Collingwood lost Taylor Adams last week, which is a big loss for them. So,
and how do you think Collingwood's going to approach this one?
Well, we sort of alluded to this on the back page of the paper today. Levi Greenwood was on the plane. He's a tagger. So he doesn't play football. He just stops other people from playing football. And the feeling is that he will go to Tim Kelly and try and shut Tim Kelly out. And so if there is no Shuey and there's no Yeo and they can limit Tim Kelly's influence, they'll feel like they've pretty much nutted the top end of the Eagles midfield. So I suspect that'll be the way they'll try and go. And they're going to have to go that way, because without Taylor Adams, they're going to struggle to generate enough ball of their own to get this done.
And like, what are you thinking as far as the score might go? You think it's going to be close? You think the Eagles might get a bit of a run on?
It could go either way. We know how strong West Coast are at Optus Stadium, and we know how quickly they come out of the blocks. It's an interesting experience, the whole Optus Stadium thing, particularly when West Coast play. The club invests a lot in the whole production. And I reckon by the time the first ball is bounced, I reckon the opposition team feels like the Christians did in the Colosseum. You know, like the seats are elevated like they were in the Colosseum. You've got these big pictures looking threateningly down at you from the scoreboard. They do this whole countdown thing where they're all, you know, giving you the stare, the Eagles flapping his wings on the big screen.
You've got videos of Nick Nat eating Whoppers. that's also pretty intimidating. but you're so right, and especially because, you know, we might see 55,000 people there. And for footy players, all of them, including Collingwood, it's been a while since they've played in front of a crowd that big.
Yeah, Collingwood, obviously they've had crowds back at the MCG this year, and Collingwood's played in front of a couple of crowds of around the 50 mark. But this is going to be a crowd where, you know, if there's 55,000 there, 50 of them are going to be screaming for your blood. So that's a bit different.
Intimidating atmosphere.
Well, we saw when Port Adelaide came, West Coast came out of the blocks and kicked four goals in the first 6 minutes, and that was the game, basically. You know, Port Adelaide then sort of steadied and the rest of it became a bit of a fight, but it was over at the 10-minute mark of the first quarter. So, yeah, you've got to really steel yourself for what's going to happen when the game starts, because the crowd gets up and about, the Eagles get up and about, and Collingwood are going to have to hang tough for a little while.
Yeah, have to match that intensity for the first quarter if they're going to have any chance. And how do you rate the Dockers' chances heading to Adelaide this week?
Well, they're playing an interesting team. They're playing the Crows, who we didn't think were going to be much good, and they've won three of their four games. And they have one of the more intriguing players in the competition, because we thought Tex Walker was finished, and he's leading the goal kicking and averaging about five or six goals a game. And the change in the way the game is played has benefited Tex more than any other player in the AFL.
Why is that? Because I was with a lot of people who thought, oh, we've seen the end of Tex, but no, he's bounced back in a massive way.
So what he is, he's built like Tarzan, but he actually plays as a leading forward. He's not a great pack-marking forward. He's not like a Tom Lynch from Richmond who crashes packs and brings the ball to ground. So he really struggled with zone defences because there was all these bodies in front of him all the time. But because of the man-on-the-mark rule and because of the reduction in rotations, the ball is flowing more, and Tex suddenly has leading lanes in front of him. He has space to lead into. And the thing about Tex, and this has always been the case with him, you give him the ball anywhere within 50 metres, he's likely to kick the goal. He is the most beautiful kick of a football you'll ever wish to see for a guy that size. So the rules are absolutely made for him.
Yeah, you think he Coleman chance?
A big Coleman chance. He's even, the way he's going at the moment, he's a chance to kick 100 goals in a season.
Which you know, hasn't been done for a while.
Well, I think Buddy was the last one back in 2008.
Yeah, well, the way the pace Tex is keeping up at the moment, he could well have it in the bag by three quarters of the way through the season.
Correct.
Yeah, amazing. And how do you think Freo are going to do?
They'll start underdogs. I won't be tipping them. But look, they've had two pretty disappointing games on the road. They'll be really determined for something better. And they're starting to get players back. And watch this space for Fremantle selection this weekend, because there's a chance Rory Lobb's going to be back about 5 weeks ahead of schedule.
Which is incredible.
From his knee injury that he suffered in that last preseason game against West Coast. So that's, we thought it was going to be 12 weeks, basically going to be about 7 if he gets up for this game. If he's fit, he won't play in the waffle. He will come straight into the AFL team, we understand.
Will we see Nat Fyfe still have the yips in front of goal?
Good question. That was an interesting thing, wasn't it? He,
the game, to say the least.
The game finished and he came back out onto the ground and did goal-kicking practice. And a few of the commentators laid into him.
Which I thought was a strange thing. Yeah, well, surely that's showing that sort of a level of professionalism that we'd want from our footy players.
So did Justin Longmuir. Justin Longmuir basically laid back into them and said, I find it staggering that people would criticise someone who's missed a few shots and wants to get better. And they gave Nat the okay to do it. So the strength and conditioning people said, yes, you can do it. You can have this many kicks. Because obviously they're cooling down and they don't want them to twang
a
hamstring. And he was only kicking from about 30 metres, so he wasn't really extending the leg and really driving through the ball. He was just trying to get his technique and his routine right. He kicked most of them too in the cool down routine. So it's probably, I suspect the big problem is between his left ear and his right ear. He needs to think about it less and just go through his routine and get it done.
And as you know, someone who reports on sport, once this thing becomes a problem, if he has another bad week, it's just going to snowball, isn't it?
Yeah, but if he kicks a couple,
it can all go away.
It just suddenly,
that's the thing with the yips, right?
It's like sitting over a 4-foot putt at a big moment, a bit like Hideki Matsuyama on the 18th green at the Masters the other day, becoming the first Japanese player to win a major. I mean, imagine the pressure that he felt over that back nine.
Amazing. And a couple of bogeys in there as well. Like it's when everything's going well, like the hole on a golf course green must seem like as big as a bucket to some players and to others as small as a pinhole.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And that's why I love the Masters, because over that last nine holes, you can see the ones that are holding up and the ones that are just melting down completely.
Oh, such mental torture. And now let's talk about Swan Districts. They've sent out a really incredible letter to AFL teams this week.
Yeah, so they wrote to all 18 clubs and they basically said, we will provide you information about how good our young players are for the draft. We will provide information about their strengths and weaknesses as footballers. But do not ask us about personality and character, because we have been honest with you in the past and traded this information with you to try and help our players get drafted. And in some cases, it's found its way back to the player and been used completely unethically and improperly. So they've said, if you want to find out what sort of person they are and what sort of character they have, you go somewhere else. Do not come to us. And they feel that they're still doing what they need to do to help their players get drafted, and they feel like they're informing clubs about their players. The reason why it's a problem for them is that if a player doesn't get drafted and they have to keep him in the waffle system, and they sort of said, oh, well, you know, he's got this problem and that problem, and the player takes offence and he finds out the club has said this and he feels it may have influence his chances of being drafted, their position with the player becomes...
He's going to be pretty disgruntled.
Exactly. And that has happened a few times, so they've decided, we're putting a stop to this. We will tell them what they are as footballers, but they're going to have to find out who they are as people from somewhere else.
And you know what? It seems like a bold strategy for Swan Districts, but it's actually no different to what happens with American colleges and the NFL. If the NFL team scouts want to find out the dirt on a player from their college career before they draft them, there's no point going to their college, because their coaches are just going to say, he's great, he's amazing, he's a wonderful young man. They need to do some digging in the communities, in the bars where the players hang out, all that sort of stuff, if they want some dirt. The exception, of course, is if they have maybe a coach has a really good relationship with a college program, then they maybe get a bit of inside information. But the programs certainly aren't just giving it out willy-nilly to anyone who asks. I think maybe the Swan Districts have a point with this one.
I think they do, yeah. If that information, and they said that four clubs had already written back to them and said, if this has been asked, we are horrified that would have happened. See, what's happening now too is that you now have, with the COVID cutbacks and the cuts to the soft caps in footy departments, you now have a lot of part-timers and a lot of casual employees, particularly, say, for Eastern States-based clubs who are kind of looking around the waffle for possible talent. So I think they're worried that maybe the standards in professionalism may drop a bit as a result of that.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a very real possibility. Now, 100 days to go until the Olympics. You excited?
I don't know.
I know exactly what you mean.
I'm
with COVID, it has totally changed the aura around the Olympics.
Yeah, it has. I don't know. I think I will be in maybe a month's time.
When it happens, I think. I think it's going to take until, well, even the opening ceremony. What are you going to see? Like, there's going to be crowds? I don't know.
Well, it depends on COVID, doesn't it? And it depends on how the vaccination programs are going and what the situation is in Japan at the moment. You know, the last Olympics, I've got to tell you this story. So my wife has to watch a lot of sport, right, just because she lives in the house with me. So she watches football and she never complains. But every now and again, she gets a bit disgruntled with all the other sports that I tend to click onto. We're sitting on the couch watching the Olympics last time round. And she was going, oh, this is boring. Oh, that's boring. You know, why are we watching this for? And then the BMX racing came on. And they came out of the gates, down the hill, first corner, massive stack. All bikes go flying everywhere. There's bodies strewn everywhere. She turns to me. She goes, this is great. All she wanted to see was a bit of carnage.
That sounds like maybe she should be watching Funny Home Videos.
Yes.
Well, Mark Duffield, thank you very much. You're doing Duff and Quarters
podcast
today.
We're doing a Duff and Quarters podcast
today. Who have you got?
You've
got Skeet?
Skeet, Golden Tonsils Reddings. He's in with me today. And Glenn Quartermain, not far from coming back to work for those who are missing Quarters. So we're going to have to find a way to – Skeet's been so great on the show. We're going to have to sort of like work out a roster and a rotation, I reckon. We're going to have to do the opposite to the AFL. We're going to have to increase our rotation.
Increase the rotation.
Have an interchange
system. Fantastic. No doubt you'll run the rule over the round five in the AFL. Thanks for being on the West Live.
Thanks, Benno.
The Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, is coming to Perth for the West Australians event series, Leadership Matters. It's happening on Thursday, April 22 at Crown Perth. This is an opportunity to hear direct from the minister who oversaw the government's economic response to the COVID crisis. The event is also a unique chance to put your questions direct to the Federal Treasurer. You don't want to miss it. You can purchase tickets at events.thewest.com.au.
The Wild West.
Joining me now in the studio, Perth Now editor Nat Richards. G'day, Nat.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. It's another day, another royal story.
Just
keep them coming. Keep them coming.
So we did say we're going down the pecking order, didn't we, as far as royal tributes go? It's almost getting laughable now.
Where are we at now?
We're down as far as Eugenie now.
Hang on. Just refresh my memory. Is this Fergie's daughter?
Yes, this is Fergie's daughter.
Is she the one wearing like the octopus tentacle hat at the
Harry and Meghan?
No, that's Beatrice. Beatrice.
That's Beatrice, the one with the one that looked like a toilet seat.
And that's her sister.
Yeah,
Eugenie
that's
and Beatrice sisters.
Eugenie's the one that had the beautiful wedding with, you know, the gorgeous.
Oh, yes,
you know,
yes, yes. I have a hard time keeping up with them.
Yes.
And so now she has paid tribute to Philip.
Yes, so Princess Eugenie has put out her statement, and it's actually one of the sweeter ones, actually. I think it's probably the best tribute.
Big call.
She said how her granddad taught her to cook. She says she remembers incinerating the sausages and you swooping in to save the day. She says she's remembering his laugh, his favourite beer, and this is the line, which is just melts hearts. Thank you for your dedication and love for us all, and especially Granny, who will look after for you. With all my love, Eugenie. And
oh, that is very sweet.
It is gorgeous. She's quite active on social media, and she just sort of, you know, she takes it all quite lightly, you know, the fact that she's a princess, she's very far down the pecking order. And look, she has some fun with it, and she's quite good fun to watch and follow.
It's really put the personal touch on it, isn't it? It's like showed the human side of Philip that's coming out through some of these tributes.
It's lovely. And the also,
loves a barbecue, apparently.
He does like a barbecue, I've heard. And also, we've got some new pictures that have been released overnight, too, which are absolutely adorable. Previously unseen photos. And they show the Queen and Philip with their great grandchildren, rather, the young children at the time, and they've got the Queen's holding Louis and Charlotte's playing up for the camera, and it's just adorable. I mean, these are photos that we would have otherwise not seen. This particular one was taken by Duchess of Cambridge, Kate, and there's some other photos in there too. There's an adorable one where you see Kate and William and George and Charlotte. And Charlotte, as a baby, is just looking straight at the Queen, and the Queen's sort of like, you can tell, just cooing at her. It's like, these are really candid moments for royals. We don't see them normally. And it's quite adorable that they're putting these out now, and we're getting to see them for the first time.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. Sad that this is the reason why we're getting to see them, but still. And now, of course, we can't do a royal segment without touching on the royal rift. Harry, William, I know. What's the latest?
So we talked yesterday about the situation with the uniforms. Yes. What's going to happen? Is Philip going to... he's not going to...
He'll be wearing his uniform.
But he won't be walking behind the coffin. William will be there, and it's potentially in a plain suit, not to embarrass Harry, of course, who's been stripped of his
military honours.
Yes. So there's talk now that the Queen has ordered that nobody wear uniform to save any sort of hassle, which I think, you know what? Family rifts are the worst, and that is fantastic.
Good on you, Betty.
Good leadership. You know what? You can't agree. We're not going to have any bickering. Nobody wears one. Good on you. I think that's fantastic. You know, it's about Philip. We don't want anything else overshadowing this situation. I mean, yes, we all love the dramas, and we in the media love to talk up all the situation with Harry and Meghan and all the rest of it. But when it comes to the day, it needs to be about respect, and it needs to be about respecting somebody who's been a member of the royal family for 70 years. So this is about respect for him. We don't want any other dramas. I think if everybody can just, you know, keep in line, do your duty, and just, you know, shut up.
Do you know what the question? The question now will be, though?
Go on.
Who looks better in the suit? is it going to be William or Harry? Who looks sharper in their suits?
We'll see. I reckon Harry might have the Hollywood touch, you see.
Like every time I see him, he looks so scruffy, whereas I think William is always so neatly presented, you know. Yeah. Like there's not a button out of place.
His shirt is perfectly pressed.
Yeah, he has to be. And so I think he will look better.
There's always one, though. There's always one situation at a funeral, isn't it? There's always one talking point. And there's going to be one.
There's going to be one.
Someone will turn up in a paisley shirt, something like that.
And keep an eye on Beatrice and Eugenie, their hats.
Yes. They have to wear hats at funerals.
The hat game is going to be very interesting too.
I know that we shouldn't be talking about fashions at a funeral. Maybe it's a bit disrespectful, but
Philip lived a long life. I think he had many privileges.
I think we're
celebrating his life, so I think we can talk about that.
Honestly,
I don't think Philip would care. That's the other thing. He'd be happy about it.
Nah. He didn't mind a headline or two, from what I've heard.
Exactly. And now, talking about headlines, here's some headline news.
I know we've talked about here becoming the Byron Bay of the West.
Yep.
And Margaret River now is the place to be because Kylie Minogue is there, guys. Kylie is in
River. What for? For a holiday?
She's here. If anybody who's been following her closely, beyond her music, will see that, you know, she's got all sorts of other side projects. She's had the perfume and everything. Now she's got wine on the go.
Well, she's doing her own wine.
Wine's the new perfume as far as celebrities go. Daniel Ricciardo's got a wine.
He's got a wine.
Yeah, we've got Shane Warne with his gin, and now we've got Kylie's got her own wine label. She's been doing it for a while, and she's out at Howard Park Winery, which is
wonderful
where
Mad
Fish is.
It's Howard
gorgeous,
Park Riesling.
Beautiful grounds
give
out
that a
there.
Go.
Gorgeous building. She's out there for a photo shoot, something to do with her promoting her new wine. We don't really know the full circumstances or how long she's going to be here for, only that it's not going to be long. So she's jetted straight into Margaret River, and she's done the photo shoot, and she's probably going to jet straight back out.
Is her winery over here, or do you know anything about that?
Kylie Winery?
Yeah.
I don't think so. It'd be good, wouldn't it? Imagine what music would be playing.
Is she just using it as a backdrop? Can you imagine if she's using a Margaret River vineyard as a backdrop for a marketing campaign for a winery that's not in Western Australia?
That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Because I guess people overseas are not going to care.
Maybe she's going to learn more about wines. It could be anything.
Good place
Maybe
to learn. Howard Park, very good.
So, yes, she's there for a photo shoot of some description that we do know.
Oh, well.
So, yeah, it's quite interesting. She's here. Look, I mean, come on, celebs, you know,
we can have a full stadium at Optus Stadium now or at RAC Arena. She should just put on a show while she's here.
It'd be nice, wouldn't
it? Sell out
the
arena. Do your
duty to WA, Kylie. Yeah, come on, exactly. Give us a show,
exactly.
Yeah,
well, ScoMo's over here.
Year.
No, we could really do with that. You know what? A benefit concert for Kalbarri.
Oh, we're starting a thing here. Starting a thing, yes.
Kylie could raise $10 million bucks.
Yeah.
Overnight.
Let's make it happen.
Okay, make it happen. I'll leave it up to you, Nat Richards in Perth now.
Yeah, it started here, guys.
Yeah, it started here. If it happens, you heard it here first.
Fantastic.
Thank you for joining me today, Nat. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, that's it from me today. You can catch us live tomorrow morning when we return to thewest.com.au and Perth Now at 8:45 a.m. And you can stream the full show whenever you want by searching for The West Live wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.
Enigma of the Dark. The Case of the Claremont Serial Killings. The must-read book that takes you inside the trial of the century. Gripping details of the case that shocked a nation. A fascinating and solid record by author Tim Clark. Order your copy now, Enigma of the Dark, from amazon.com.au.